are listening to Teacher Toolkit, supporting teachers, parents and students worldwide.
So it's kind of trying to get the best of different international models. You know, there are very good things about the West and the Western education systems, and there's very good things about the Asian and East side, and we need to kind of take the best that will fit into the cultural context of that country.
We help teachers thrive and survive with classroom ideas, cutting-edge school resources, and research-informed teacher training materials. You will also hear discussions on the policy, guidance, and research-based publications.
This week, listen to Ross McGill, founder of Teacher Toolkit, interview Jennifer Chang Waffle, part-time lecturer at the University of Hong Kong, an educational consultant specializing in content-based curriculums and instruction. In today's podcast, some of the things we'll be discussing are what makes a great maths teacher, how education in the classroom has changed as a result of EdTech, and the strengths and weaknesses of education in the East and in the West.
Hello everyone, this is Ross at Teacher Toolkit, the most influential blog on education in the UK. Today I am delighted to introduce you to Jennifer Chang Waffle. Jennifer, could you introduce yourself to our listeners and tell everybody what you do and where you are?
Sure, Ross. Yeah, thank you, first of all, for having me on your podcast. It was great when you reached out to me, and I thought it'd be a great chance for us to catch up. Yeah. So I am an educational consultant, and my specialty areas are concept-based curriculum and instruction, with sometimes a particular focus in mathematics. And I think that's becoming a lot more of my work, the mathematics, because I think there's a big need for education reform when it comes to, you know, teaching and learning of mathematics. I'm a part-time lecturer at the University of Hong Kong, so that's where I'm based. Yes. I'm sure that a lot of people have seen a lot of things on the news recently about our home here. But besides that, I get to travel the world and meet wonderful people like you and connect so, lots of educators around the world.
So for our listeners, just for context, Jennifer and I, we met in March in Switzerland.
Yes. That's correct.
A conference where we both led some workshops, which was really exciting. So it's 9 months later. So what have you been doing the last 9 months?
Oh, wow. What haven't I been doing?
What are the highlights?
I think the highlights really are that most of my work is really school partnerships, long-term school partnerships, developing curriculum, whether it's across the board in many discipline areas or just with a focus in mathematics. And I think a lot of schools and educational institutions are recognizing the importance of ongoing, sustained professional learning. You know, the one-and-done model really does not work if you want to have true impact on student learning and a true impact on pedagogy. So a lot of schools now engage with me for 3 to 5 years where I work as a coach. So I have a lot of ISBs. I work with a lot of schools that are ISO. So it's Beijing. I think I've worked with Brussels. There's Bali. So there's a lot of long-term partnerships with ISBs. But basically, different continents, you know, there'll be different educational institutions.
So I'm going to push your memory banks here. Now, I know you've been working in education for 25 years, but could you go back to your, just give listeners a broad overview of your own education as a child?
Yeah, sure. I was very fortunate, actually, as a child that I loved school. My father was really the main role model for me, who encouraged our whole family to value education. And he himself was a village boy from China with no education. But he's one of those wonderful success stories where he joined the diplomatic corps and he represented his government. And we got to travel as a family all over the world as I was growing up. So education was always really important, and I was fortunate to always have wonderful maths teachers, which is not always the case, is it? A lot of people I meet
Did you find yourself in lots of different schools throughout your childhood?
a few different schools. There were mainly, I think, 4 to 5 year assignments, so it wasn't too disruptive. And I think by the time that I was about 12, my father, you know, retired and for, I think, my brother and our benefit, so that we could actually just stay in one place. And that's where you hear the accent. Yes. So wherever you spend your teenage years, I think, is where you attain your accent.
Mine is from Lancashire in northwest England, but I'm Scottish and I've lived in London for 25 years and Wales, funny enough, but my Lancashire accent has stuck.
I don't know. There's a bit of London, not South London, but a bit of London in there too. Yeah. And so, it's something you can't shake off,
no,
right?
You can't. elocution.
So what's my accent, Ross?
Well, I'm going to... I'm going to be brave and say Canadian.
Oh my goodness! No one's ever said that before.
Australian.
It's slightly Australian. Yeah, slightly Australian. Yeah.
God, it's a diverse and complicated world we live in, and
it
fascinating. It is. Let me just unpick the maths part. Tell me some highlights of what made great maths teaching as a pupil for you.
I've listened to some of your other podcasts with other maths educators, and we actually all kind of, I think, experienced similar things in that we found maths accessible. It was fun. We loved the critical thinking and the puzzles, and we found it quite easy. And I always had wonderful teachers who connected with me and built a relationship. So I think that's probably the most important thing in terms of teaching, being able to connect with an individual student and build that very special relationship and rapport of trust and respect. I want to tell you a story, actually.
Yes,
that's
please.
Quite fascinating. Well, when I was 12 years old, so I'd loved maths all the way through, and when I was 12 years old, my mother actually, she's Chinese from Taiwan, so she took me to the mountains of Taiwan with my brother to see this fortune teller. So in Chinese culture, when you tell someone's fortune, you actually look at their face and you look at their expressions and you look at how their face is structured.
So they were looking at you just at 12 years old?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
And so the fortune teller looked into my face and she said, oh, you're going to be a maths educator for the rest of your life and actually, you know, make this into your career. And I was quite amazed at the time. And she looked into my brother's face and she said, you're going to be a doctor. So my brother is a doctor with his own practice in Australia.
Yes.
And I enjoyed a glorious 27 years in the classroom.
Incredible.
I'm a classroom practitioner at heart. I'm a teacher at heart.
Yeah, so I'm going to talk about your doctorate in a moment, because that's where I'm currently at after 25 years in the classroom. I want to explore a bit more from your school life. And I know you went to the University of Sydney and Hong Kong, but where did the teaching journey start for you?
The teaching journey started pretty much straight out of university. And my first full-time teaching position was in Hong Kong. But I private tutored students since the age of 14.
Right.
And so in Australia, I used to, you know, I bought my first car based on, you know, tutoring kids and normally younger kids or my peers actually in mathematics. So I taught from about 14 to, you know, 21. Then I came to Hong Kong and found a teaching job pretty quickly, was very fortunate to find a teaching job. And you know, I've been very lucky ever since working in different types of international schools.
Okay.
I've had an opportunity to work in New York at the original IB school there.
Right.
And just to experience different cultures and meet a lot of different international students
What are the key things for you that you think have changed in your time when you started as a teacher?
Oh, huge shifts in pedagogy and approach. Definitely. I think when I was first teaching, we were using overhead projectors. I don't know if you remember them.
I started on a blackboard, actually, before OHPs,
Well, we had, I can't remember what they were called, but you know those worksheets?
Yeah.
Where they had alcohol and it was blue? What were those machines called?
Is it a Bander machine?
Yeah, something like that.
Photocopier, yeah.
Yeah. So I used to use those. And then we had overhead, well, we had whiteboards before the blackboards and after the blackboards. And then we used overhead projectors. And I remember writing copious lecture notes on these overhead projectors and lecturing for 45 minutes and, you know, just probably assuming that the
it was a craft in itself creating the worksheets because they were you know, it was very detailed, whereas today you can copy something off the internet quite quickly and save a bit of time. Do you think the introduction of ed tech has been beneficial or an increase in workload?
Oh, I think it's definitely been beneficial, and it's all how you embed, how you use it, and which tool to choose to actually enhance learning. Mm-hmm. So, of course, we can use technology for the sake of it at a very low level, substitution level, but I think it's important that we choose the right tool so that it enhances learning and that it adds to the student's experience so that they understand on a higher level and a deeper level, you know, the concepts in particular.
How do you see this shift in the last 20 odd years has changed maths teaching for the better?
Well, so if I started off lecturing at the front of the room for 45 minutes, now, I mean, I only left school 2 years ago, and that was actually a very difficult decision for me. But in the last 2 years, and I still get to co-teach when I visit schools, so now it is 8 minutes of talking, you know, around 8 to 10 minutes, and the rest is student engagement. There's a lot of inquiry learning. There's a lot of group discussions rather than me standing at the front. In fact, there is no front of the classroom. You know, there are flexible fronts where there's lots of discussions going on. And I would say the classroom learning looks completely different to how I started. You know, I've changed, evolved quite a lot.
And tell me more about your doctorate.
Oh, so that's in educational technology. Okay. I've wanted to pursue an area that was not necessarily maths education because I've been in maths education for nearly 30 years now, and I wanted to learn something new. I wanted to be uncomfortable. Right. You know, I didn't want to be comfortable and pursue and research something that I knew quite a lot about. So I chose something that I didn't know very much about.
That's very brave.
Yeah. And I think it gives you confidence at the end of the day once you go through the process. And, you know, it is daunting because there's a lot of new literacies, new digital literacies that, you know, I was very unfamiliar with. I'm a child from the 80s. So, you know, we did not have mobile phone. I didn't have a mobile phone, I think, until I was like 28, 30, no, over 30.
I was 25, I think.
You were 21.
25 or 26, I think, my first mobile phone. Yeah.
Exactly. So we didn't have access to the internet, social media, and we could look anything up. You know, I'm from, like, even on my assignments, I was using a typewriter to type things up when I was at university. So it was something that I wanted to learn about and to put myself in an uncomfortable situation and to be challenged.
So what would your top tips be for teachers who are younger and born into this social media era in terms of just managing their classroom, managing assignments, or wanting to start research?
Yeah, I think it's very important how you select the tool and that it's not the tool. The tool is not to blame if things don't go wrong. Mm-hmm. So, or if things do go wrong, I must say. So you can't blame a computer or an inanimate object if your students are distracted or they're not learning or they're not engaged. Mm-hmm. That means that the expectations that you have given and the tool that you have chosen is perhaps not the right tool and you haven't given the right expectations. So I know that there are some schools, I won't name which country, but there are some schools in some countries that have actually banned the use of mobile phones and computers in, and I'm sure you're familiar, Ross.
Oh, yes, we're very familiar with this. But it's an interesting one because, you know, having, and I'm sure in Hong Kong also, you work with children in poverty and difficult circumstances, just like any part of the world, particularly cities. But we have this approach here that, and in some cases, it's a total ban. I guess for various reasons, our schools here in England are particularly underfunded. So there's not often, it's either you're relying on the people that are driving the technology or the funding. And I guess if you don't have either, There's an Achilles heel, so to speak, so you can't necessarily provide everyone with a device, so you're relying on children to bring their own, and then it's not a level playing field, and then the technology doesn't work, and then so some schools just go for the easy option to ban it, to reduce bullying and all sorts of things.
Which I think, you know, can really disadvantage students from learning, from being preparing them for society and jobs and the workforce and university later.
Our current framework here in England is to, if we assume a school's banned phones, it's to get their heads down to pass the exam to create a level playing field there. In absence of evaluating if the bell curve is fair and all those types of things. What I want to talk about, in terms of your setting in Hong Kong and the schools that you visit on your travels, what are the reoccurring workload issues for teachers?
I think, I mean, I know that that's something that you've been researching and it's an area that you really have a lot of experience in, and it's universal. Yes. The workload issue, I probably say, except for a couple of places like in China, where they teach one grade level and they have a lot of, you know, free time to be able to collaborate and plan classes. It's a completely different, I think, scheduling, you know, for teachers in China. Mm-hmm. But besides China, I think most places the teacher workload is overwhelming because I think as teachers, most of us really care about our students' progress and learning, and we probably, you know, do our utmost to prepare lessons, to deliver the lessons, and then to try and offer as much feedback as possible. And we want to do our students the best service that we can. And I know, you know, there are many pressures and demands that teachers have. Mm-hmm. And I think the biggest one that I hear is always time.
Yes.
Is so that the one that you hear?
Yes. And the specifics are often marking, planning, and you know, the administration, because the vast majority of the teachers here in England are at least committed to their timetables to 90%, and the rest of the time
is a high percentage.
So
often teaching seven grade levels. In the US, it's middle school, so you've only got a few grade levels in high school, which is only four grade levels. But UK teachers teach 6 to 7 different year levels. Which is even more prep.
On that note, what's your top tips for teachers to manage time better and to find margins?
Do you know what the secret is that I found? That the secret is collaboration and sharing. And sharing resources with your colleagues and team teaching and trying to develop a scheme of work, a curriculum where you showcase the best learning experiences for your students, not only allow students to have some consistency in the approach, but at the same time, you know, you allow teachers to celebrate their individuality as well. So I think the key is collaboration in terms of developing curriculum and sharing resources.
Fantastic. Now, in London today, it's the Education World Forum, where the likes of the OECD gurus and all the politicians of our world, and I'm sure some Hong Kong representatives are here also. And I've got the OECD PISA results in front of me on the screen here.
Now, I saw them.
We know Hong Kong, Macau and Singapore and Beijing, Shanghai are, you know, top and quite unique settings, and on my travels, you know, particularly Beijing and Shanghai, as the huge number of pupil population itself is greater than some countries in some respects.
Yes, that's right.
Which is quite fascinating. But could you give me what are your one thing? What's the one thing you'd like to see change in education, and a message that you'd like politicians perhaps to hear if they were listening to this podcast?
I suppose, I mean, there are so many things that we need to do, right? In China, the great success.
I'm
going to give you some background, and I'm going to give you one because it's so difficult. So, you know, the reason why Asian countries, and in particular Beijing and Shanghai, are so successful in the PISA results is because teachers actually come in with a mathematics degree. They're specialists, so they're not generalists.
Yes.
And they're given a lot of professional development, collaboration. Same in Singapore. They're given over 100 hours of professional learning every year.
Shanghai teaches 40 days a year.
Yes. So I think that other countries can learn. We can learn from each other, you know, the best of different systems. And one of those things that we can learn, one key idea that we can learn from the Asian countries is the idea of professional learning and giving teachers more, I think, opportunities to develop their own pedagogy and their own practice, more time, I think, to develop curriculum. So it's kind of trying to get the best of different international models. You know, there are very good things about mm-hmm. the West and the Western education systems, and there's very good things about the Asian and East side, and we need to kind of mm-hmm. take the best that will fit into the cultural context of that country.
Yeah. And then your one tip for politicians, can I just maybe reference your concept-based curriculum here as well?
Yes. I think the one tip, I think, is the funding, because Singapore, the Ministry of Education and the government, they actually invest a lot of funding into their education system, and that's why they're so progressive. So it's about funding and valuing the importance of it. I was listening to one of your podcasts and heard that, you know, Ofsted is about to
It's looking to inspect more outstanding schools. So the best schools have been exempt from inspection in some cases for over a decade.
Right.
The government want to fund inspection more. A lot of debate is that they've got a new framework, but there's more of the same issues, that if you choose to work in a challenging school where you've got the vast majority of pupils from low-income families, then it's harder to achieve a higher badge rating by the inspectorate. So my argument often is, why choose to work in those schools if it ends your career? How are we going to entice more teachers to those settings, and is the grading methodology reliable? I believe my doctoral research want to explore that it actually does the opposite.
Yeah, so my recommendation would be to take away all the inspections and those judgmental snapshot, you know, kind of grading systems of different schools. And I think the biggest would be reduce standardized testing.
Yes.
We don't need GCSEs.
It's interesting that the vast majority of people that have worked in the classroom in educational settings keep saying the same solutions, but yet the politicians outside choose to ignore us. I believe it's under this guise that it's what parents want. I just think we just keep repeating the same old problems.
Yes.
Okay, so just to finish off, Jennifer, I'm going to throw loads of quick fire questions at you. And I'm going to try something new. I'm going to put some background kind of countdown music on to give you a bit of pressure.
Okay, great.
Now, fingers crossed it doesn't ruin the recording. But so here we go. Let me just get my set of questions up. I'm going to start the music, and every time you answer, I'll reset it. So fingers crossed, otherwise I'll give up if it crashes. Okay, my first question is, what's the project you're currently working on right now?
I would say school partnerships and developing curriculum, and it's a 3 to 5 year cycle. So we have a draft plan, but then we co-create different parts of the development stages. So I like to call it PIE. We have the planning, we have the implementation, then we have the evaluation stage.
Okay, fantastic. What's your project that you're working on outside of education, so at home?
Oh, I think I'm all consumed by my work. I love my work.
But what are you doing at home? What are your home projects?
My home projects. I've got to think really carefully. I don't have a home life.
Yes, I caught you out. Okay. Next question. What books are you reading at the moment?
I like to read several books on the go. So yes. I'm reading Nuance by Michael Fullan. Uh-huh. I just started reading Launch. I think that's by Jeffrey Walker.
Okay.
I'm just finishing off. I like to read several books and dip in. So I'm just finishing off The Culture Code.
Great.
The Secrets of Highly Successful Groups. That's a good one by Daniel Coyle. Yeah.
Okay, fantastic. What's your piece of advice for a teacher who wants to begin research?
To begin research, I would, and I think many people recommend this, join the community on the Twitter sphere.
Right.
I always say that is the best professional learning that I receive every single day.
Okay, yeah,
and there's a lot of research that you can read and just start to take an interest in on the Twitter sphere.
Okay, top tips for writing a book?
You have to decide at some stage to walk away from it, so you'll feel like it's an unfinished piece of art. And because you can keep editing and go on forever, but you have to decide at one day. Can you relate to that?
Yes, I'm laughing, yeah. Okay, what would be your dream job if you weren't doing what you're doing today?
Do you know what? I am living the dream. This is my dream job. I get to, you know, meet lots of people around the world. I say that I'm slowly eating my way around the world.
Great. Okay, so on that note, I was going to ask, what's your favorite Hong Kong dish?
My favorite Hong Kong dish would be, it's a dish that's called salty fish eggplant.
Oh, nice. Top tip landmark for tourists visiting Hong Kong if they had half a day?
The Peak, definitely. I regularly walk up. It's about a 45-minute walk from where I am. I can see it from my window. Definitely The Peak. Yeah.
I would have to say Hong Kong's probably one of my top destinations in the world. It's a fabulous
excellent
city. Yeah. It's got everything, mountains, the sea, the view, the city feel, everything, and the food.
Yeah, and beaches.
And the beaches, yeah. And who would you recommend I interview next and why?
Have you heard of Dr. James Tanton?
I haven't, no.
Okay, he is an amazing mathematician at large, he calls himself. He was the creator of the Global Math Week, which has over 10 million students and teachers participating. And we participate in an activity that he created called Exploding Dots.
Right, you got that one in just in time. Okay, and then a couple more questions. What would you want to be your legacy?
My legacy actually is to try to really encourage math education reform. And actually my legacy is something that I work towards to leave a name for my father. I've dedicated everything to my father. Yeah.
Okay, excellent. And final question, Jennifer. Where can listeners find out more about you? Online, your books, your blogs, your site?
Right. Okay, my website is jennifer.changwathel.com or at Jennifer Wathel on Twitter. Actually, if you just search Wathel, I think I'm the only Jennifer Wathel in the world.
Right, fantastic. W-A-T-H-A-L-L. Right, I'm going to stop the music. You did really well, and I'm pleased that everything worked. So we've got a bit of pace on the podcast, and we've come in about 25 minutes, so that's pretty good.
Perfect.
Research and tips for teachers. So, Jennifer, it's been lovely to connect with you again.
Thank you.
I hope to see you on our travels somewhere in the world in the not-too-distant future.
I think that's what's so exciting about our roles, right? We will see each other in some continent somewhere.
Circuit. Yeah, it is fascinating. For me, it's only my third year doing this, and I feel like I'm an NQT, a new teacher all over again, doing it in a different setting. And plus my research is I'm only in my second year part-time, so I've got a long way to go with that yet.
Fantastic, though.
Anyway, it's been a pleasure to chat with you.
And thank you for everything that you're doing, actually. I love the work and what you're doing in terms of teacher workload and just helping teachers.
Thanks, Jennifer. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And best wishes to you and to all your listeners and people that you work with in Hong Kong and the wider parts of the world. Thanks again.
Okay, thank you, Ross. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To continue the conversation, head over to www.teachertoolkit.co.uk and our social media channels to access all the links and resources mentioned on today's show. Why not share this with your colleagues and give them the gift of time, reduced workload, and increased impact? Until the next time, before you look after your students, look after yourself.